this kind of panorama of the uses of the Neolithic. And I think, of course, there's several correspondences between the two talks and also the transition of pre-war uses to post-war uses and the kind of emphasizing different aspects, but nevertheless, no, the what shined through is this, there is a kind of something of the unruliness of the different uses becomes more geared towards a kind of standardized universalism. And perhaps that's also a paradigm we are still in, although I wonder if what you were thinking insofar as you are following, and maybe I could start with that, although I don't know if you have been following this debate, since there is so much recent rewriting of the transition of the Paleolithic to Neolithic, what you were making of it, what you were making of the discussion around a site such as Göbekli Tepe in southern Anatolia, which has been digged up in the 90s by a German archaeologist whose name escapes me right now, mm-hmm. Fischer or something, and is still subject to intense, no, reinterpretation, because also the whole sequence is at stake, the mm-hmm. sequence that then sort of fueled the standard narratives of what came first, no, in the sequence of domestication, architecture, mm-hmm. Then certain forms of organized religion, the temple, etc. Have you been following Göbekli Tepe, for instance, or similar cases in Japan, where also this? Yeah.
Well, there has been an acceleration in a sense, right? An acceleration in the rewriting and the contestation of sort of established accounts of mm-hmm. prehistory, early history. So I think this is also, I guess, then part of our own Pleasantsight. There is again this moment when there really is something at stake, right? But I think more than in the past. More than in the past, perhaps, there is now also what, of course, you have dealt with here at the HKW with ape culture. There is also the sense now that there has to be a kind of, we have to take back a step even further, and the whole division of the human, you know, even the early prehistorical human and the animal has to be challenged. Right? This is something certainly that you've dealt with here, and I think this is very much part of the contemporary use or usage of the prehistoric as a kind of flexibility, you could say, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Right? This is where the presentness, and the presence, the contemporaneity of the prehistoric, I think, articulates itself to a certain extent, and this is something that we haven't been able to deal with here today so far. But yeah, ape culture for me would really be sort of, in a sense, the next step in unpacking this.
I mean, maybe one. Yeah.
No, I agree that, of course, everybody knows, I think, that today the discourse, the debates on this, all the origins, the geological origins, the human origins is really present. And of course, it is a sign of our own historicity and of the crisis that we are going through. And it is not the first time, actually. I think that it is not at all fortuitous that prehistory was invented during the big industrial revolution, and that deep time it is the other phase of modern acceleration. And after that, Karl Einstein was someone who really understood and who wrote that in a way, during fascism, one has to write a history of the long durée, because in this way, man can really live the present and see the dynamics of social organization, of the structures, and not the events, in a way. In regard to the Neolithic, actually, the rewriting of this narrative right now is more focalized actually on this asynchronicity of the different Neolithic inventions. Of course, I mean, the historicist way to understand history before wanted that everything was a totality and there was everything was simultaneous with everything the other thing. But I still think that the notion of revolution, which has been very criticized, and with reason, if we are a prehistorian, is very interesting for us historians, in a way. Because, of course, I mean, the Neolithic was not something that happened in a day or in a year or in a decade. But the thing that we needed to invent the Neolithic revolution is very important because it shows us the way that we are understanding our history and the thing that now, the end of the Neolithic revolution also is showing the turn that we are trying to put that we leave, in a way.
But would you agree that that one could perhaps classify the uses of prehistory of the Neolithic, and we might make that more specific, but let's keep it that rough also to do justice to the diversity of cases you have invoked, could be roughly classified in two different ways. On the one hand, as a kind of border-making mechanism, as an origin scene that operates by positing an initial scission, such as the entry into, you know, the escape from animality in the Paleolithic, no? or the kind of entry into a proper symbolic universe in its kind of ensuing narrative canon of narratives, you know, of speaking of the rise of, you know, the rise of civilization, the empire, etc. So on the one hand, this kind of, you know, history of this, the use of prehistory, the use of the Neolithic as a method to operate this decision, to make a boundary that operates, in fact, in the present. Mm-hmm. And on the other, in order to gain a kind of boundless, a kind of universal, you know, legitimacy, value, meaning, etc. And also this kind of, perhaps the ICA founding exhibition might be a case in point here for this kind of post-war universalism that seeks to kind of evade the uncomfortable questions of legitimacy and pre-war struggles by just enlarging the scale and creating this kind of flat continuity in which legitimacy can wander freely between cultural phenomena.
Yeah, exactly, but of course we have to see that ultimately there is no flat continuity, and that, for instance, Bataille, I think, as I read him, does not really give pride of place, you know, to this first novelty in human history, to the Neolithic Revolution. For him, the key event is another event. Whereas Einstein, you know, why did Einstein name that article Neolithic Childhood? You know, for me, that's really intriguing. Of course, he would have been well aware of this notion of the Neolithic Revolution, which I think was introduced in 1922 or thereabouts. And then he has all these cliché tropes in this essay. You know, as children, we imagined, you know, that we lived in a Negro village down south or something like that, you know. So that kind of horrible imagery. But Neolithic childhood, right? So there is this, you could immediately also autocomplete Neolithic differently, right? Not Neolithic childhood, but Neolithic revolution. So what is the kind of constellation that he creates there with this seemingly backward-looking modus operandi, right? A more sort of a traditional tribal society that we lived in as children, engaging in acts of symbolic cannibalism, etc. But by invoking the term Neolithic, he still put it in this, let's say, linear progression, right? So he went back to childhood in sort of a seemingly very conventional primitive manner, but then he sort of put in a reverse gear and introduced this forward-looking sort of propulsion of the Neolithic revolution, which he doesn't really, you know, use as a trope in the text, but I think it's there. It must have been there in 1930 in the very name, right? So that's where I think that essay becomes really messy in a rather interesting manner. Mm-hmm. And I think Einstein is often at his most interesting when that happens.
Yeah, maybe there is also a more trivial reason, which is that he's talking about Hans Arp. And Arp was, I mean, his artistic idiom. I mean, I don't want to be a nasty art historian, you know. But I mean, his forms are more compatible with the Neolithic. Because in other texts, Einstein, he uses more the Paleolithic magic trope. So actually, he's using what is more convenient each time. And I think that it's also interesting to underline that at that time, even if Einstein had a very subversive reading of history, still I think that Bataille was much more radical in his historical interpretation. Because for Bataille, in 29 or 30, there was no structure in history, there was no direction. History was completely formless, was completely contingent. For Einstein, as he wrote it in the little text on the collage of Miró, there is a cycle and there is a repetition. There is a pattern in history, which in a way it is something that is also very reconforting. I mean, it is something that helps to leave crisis. For Bataille, at that moment, there was nothing. I mean, man had just fictions. That's all he had, which is a lot, of course.
But of course, Bataille also participated in something that was, one could probably write a whole sort of canon of the time, which is, and I don't remember now who quoted that, but I think it is coming from a letter by Adorno where he speaks of the kind of the currency and that at the time an anthropology of fear has, no? And that's like in the sense of this kind of the emphasis on the violence of exiting the animal matrix, of the prevailing that this fiction is always a reaction already to an originary of a primeval fear, and Einstein in fact also participates in that canon, but a little less so than or a little less radical, and of course they are not the only ones, right? It's
you might say Bataille's radicalism in part lies in the fact that really for Bataille there was only ever one event, one novelty, which was precisely the becoming human of the animal. That's, in a sense, all that matters. All the rest is a series of attempts to deal with this trauma.
Exactly.
It's all about that trauma.
Yeah, and but there is also another event, which is the end of the human, which is completely symmetrical. When man stops doing art and...
But that's Kojève's great fear, right? That's Kojève's great fear. What happens after the end of history? Do we become animals again? Do we regress?
We are satisfied.
Yeah, exactly. We're satisfied.
So then, there's nothing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, are we then dealing with this whole complex, this Neolithic or this use of prehistory complex with a male conspiracy? Are we dealing with a male conspiracy?
Aren't we always?
Yes, a male conspiracy, yes.
I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, there is a certain, there's this fear and this kind of the heroicism and the detournement of the heroic, etc. But it still is so much based on this kind of this rupture, no? This mm-hmm. second birth, this entry into the symbolic that... and then the trouble of remembering where one really comes from, mm-hmm. and the darkness of the symbolic openness, etc. Mm-hmm. So it just smells a lot of...
Of course, the entry into the symbolic is the entry into, or in Lacanian terms, you would say, of course, it's the entry into the law of the father. But of course, another issue that we haven't touched upon here is also the pervasive strand in 19th and 20th century accounts of early history or prehistory, which is the theory that actually early culture was matriarchal, right, and not patriarchal, mm-hmm. right, and that actually the patriarchal is a later social formation that actually also came with agriculture, right, and it actually emerged when a culture became sedentary. This whole, and Engels was one of the exponents of that, of course, but it's quite pervasive. So actually, that is another strand, this actually reading of early human history, of prehistory in terms that are, if not feminist, you know, then at least in some ways proto-feminist.
I'd like to invite you to join this conversation.
I would like to focus it on a question developed by Bataille in the Dictionary of Documents, the critique of architecture, which is linked to the body, and the museum, which is also developed in concern of archaic rituals. This perspective and the question would be more about which place was the monstrous in the arguments you did to develop. Is there a link in between the prehistoric discourse with this idea of the monstrous, which is much more in the so-called Niedermaterialismus, or how we have to think about this concept?
Well, actually, when I worked in the archives of Georges Bataille at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, I discovered a dossier, a folder, where he had written monkeys. Well, I opened it, of course, very curious, and I found an incredible photograph that I have never seen published before, which shows a monkey, a very big monkey, with a kind of a hood under his, please help me, I'm completely tired. at the end of your chin, yes? Here. How do you call this part of the face?
Yeah, chin.
Okay.
But he had what on it?
He had a good, it was a very vertical thing like that, because actually this monkey was dead. And the explorers, geologists, paleontologists, which were in Venezuela, they wanted him to be seated like a man, with this stuff in order to give him verticality. And actually, in the same folder, there was an article of a racist who would be executed by French resistance after the Two World War, Montandon, who was talking about this monkey, and he found in him the missing link between man and the monkey. Anyway, so when I saw the date of this publication, it was 29, which means that this is the source of the article in Document on architecture. Because we have really the animal which is architectonized, and the monstrous is the other face of this assemblage. So, yes, I do think that there is a relation.
Thank you. It's mainly for Maria. I wondered then, so I'm sort of going back to this proto, possibly feminist idea. Are there any female artists that you explore using these neo-paleolithic kind of tropes in the work within the modernist canon? Are there any female artists doing this at that time? Because the artists you showed are male and have reputations within the canon for being chauvinistic and misogynistic in a lot of senses, and even Picasso's work was a kind of Neolithic realization of a female form, the one with the, in particular, I wonder if there were female artists responding to this history or linearity of it.
During the 30s, there is a very important female artist, is Barbara Hepworth, yeah, who is just does what male artists are doing. You
yeah,
know, it
course,
is vertical, it is in the earth. I mean, you can find no difference between them. After that, you have other artists, as Louise Bourgeois, etc., who are trying to find more interesting ways to question this prehistorical imaginary and its feminine nature. Yeah.
Are there any before 1930 that are doing this? Women artists, because the Picassos were before 1930 that you showed. Are there any women doing it in the 10s or 20s that are that you know of?
Not as far as I know. I don't really know. No.
Because Hepworth always comes to mind whenever ARP is brought up for me. I think the forms are similar when you compare.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there have been comparisons of those forms in exhibitions quite recently at the Hepworth Gallery and other places. But I was wondering if there were other female artists who were, you know, maybe not so obvious that they were doing this, but maybe.
But
so, okay, you don't know. Okay,
sorry.
Fine. Thank you.
So, am I allowed to go back to the male conspiracy? Because actually, Sven, when you show the image, the photograph of Georges Bataille sitting in the cave of Lascaux, the immediate thing that it reminded me of was actually an earlier photograph of André Breton sitting in the Palais Idéal of this postman who,
Facteur Cheval,
this postman who actually constructed this. So actually, I think the answer to your question is absolutely right in some ways. It's a return to origins, but this origins in the 1930s was very explicitly imagined as a maternal womb. And so there are actually, Tristan Tzara would write about this, you know, the desire to go back to the womb in the face of, you know, crisis in some ways. So the deep time can be deep womb in some ways that they're trying to escape. You know, I don't really have a question. It's just something that reminded me of this. But I also think it's worth thinking about the ways in which Georges Bataille somehow imagines this form of primitive femininity, primitive mother, in an almost kind of very antagonistic form, as the absolute antipode of masculinity, right? As a transgressive force. But I don't really see this as, to me, it's like only one possibility in the 30s, right? So you have so many different theoretical possibilities. You have this kind where you think this female has to be this absolute, formless, transgressive. But then, thinking about this, I thank you, Sven, for reminding about the Homo Ludens as an antagonist to the Homo Faber. But I'm smiling also because Walter Benjamin had actually written about, you know, in some ways, play already in the late 1920s, exactly the same time as Einstein and Bataille writing about children's art. And for Benjamin, one of the nice things about toys is that they come from the workshops. So they come from Homo Faber, right? They come from the craftsmen. So Homo Ludens is Homo Faber. The workman who is tired of making his furniture will make a doll. You know, there's no antagonism between this Homo Faber, Homo Ludens. You can have play and work. You don't have to make such a, you know, clear distinction. The Facteur Cheval, the postman, he built that Palais Idéal over 27 years. He worked very hard, you know. But at the same time, it was also Homo Ludens. So I think this is very interesting because
This is where things really get interesting, right? When you can use Benjamin and his, in a sense, far more dialectical use of those terms, in particular the concept of Homo Faber, and you can use that also to critique Bataille, who tends to be, in this respect, at least think more in terms of dichotomies rather than in terms of dialectical relations.
The Bataille of Lascaux is completely different from the Bataille of Ducimont.
Yeah.
I mean, he needs faith, in a way, which was not the case before.
Hello. I just wanted to note that there is this article in Ducimont called Le Sacre Féminin. Maybe you know it. And so I just have a question for Bataille. And do you think... When how to come out of the crisis, so there was this idea to see history in general and to go back and study and see similarities. But then you said that, Sven, that Bataille, for him, history was just this moment when the animal became man. So do you think his idea of coming out of the crisis is a man becoming the animal again, like in his interest in extreme human emotions and trance and drugs and so on?
No, I think for Bataille,
this it's a matter not of becoming animal again in sort of any in any final manner, but it's a manner of always stepping back into the world of sovereignty, right? The world of the animal is the world of sovereignty, and it's a matter of always stepping back into that world in certain frameworks, in the context of rituals, in the context of certain activities that, of course, are also then part of society, that have some kind of, you know, social framework, so they become part of the world of homogeneity. They become part of the profane world. But within this profane world, there need to be certain protocols in place, if you will, that allow you to do that, you know, and then to step back again, you know, to step over the brink, in a sense, but then also to have some kind of escape back into the world of daily life, of the profane, of labor. Mm-hmm. That's what I say. That's Bataille's, in a sense, sense of what it is to be human. And I don't think that, in contrast to Kojève or others, maybe, I don't think he tends to think in terms of an apocalyptic moment in the future. In a way, it's about sticking with that. It's about sort of tarrying with the negative, in a sense, with this negation, with this transgressive negation the world of Homo Faber in those socially sanctioned manners, but also, of course, in the form of transgressive activities that may really not be socially sanctioned, crime and forms of truly transgressive eroticism and so on.
Yeah, and still, I mean, I agree with you, but in the same time, the apocalyptic moment, in a way, for him, there is a good apocalyptic moment, which is the moment of rapture, but this apocalyptic moment is always individual. I mean,
yes.
What is really, maybe we should think that the problematic aspect of Bataille's thought after the war is that he recognizes really no political margin. I mean, everything is strictly personal.
That's when he basically becomes a mystic, right? Like Sartre said, this mystic without God.
Yeah.
And I think there is this moment also thinking in your terms, you know, of the individual or the solipsistic and the collective. There is, of course, this moment of real investment in collectivity, of a desperate investment
in the
collectivity
30s.
In the 30s, mm-hmm. right? With the Collège de Sociologie and with Assefal in particular. So there was that, yeah. But that
after
was
that, it was...
Yeah.
Kerstin?
Directly in relation to that, because I would, I mean, for example, in, when is it? One of the late interviews, when Bataille argues that he refuses any kind of responsibility for this world. And I don't think that this is anti-political. I think this is extremely political.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's more political in relation to what Sven was talking about with the notion of expenditure or the eroticism thing. When he talks about like all modern, like all sexuality within the lineage of progressive history is prostitution, because it's all labor, then this notion of expenditure, I think, becomes a form of politics which is deviating from modern politics because it deviates from the progressivism of history in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if this might link actually to the Robert Morris example you were speaking about.
There are personal devices to escape this over-determination in the social reality that we share. But at the same time, I mean, Bataille is very clear in his writings in the 50s that we are in post-history. So I really cannot understand, I mean, does it help to think that we are in a post-history? I mean, I'm not a Marxist, but... In the same time, I am wondering how we can define human action in order to try to change reality. I mean, for me, history, of course, there is a subversive potential in the thinking of Bataille, but I cannot see how this subversive potential can exceed the personal experience of rapture with the collective one. To go to the collective effect. I don't know. I mean, it is really a problem for me. I don't have the answer.
Well, I see Kirsten's point, which is indeed a very Kirstinian point.
Mm-hmm.
but I think it does require it does require you to read some of late Bataille against the grain, but I think that indeed is a very legitimate and I would even say important exercise.
Mm. Yeah, we have time for maybe one more question, but we could also extend the break. No, we have one question. So.
Not a question. Just a short notice regarding there is a wonderful photo in the exhibition. Wolfgang Palen has bought this huge part of a building, the forefront. In one of his voyages to the north, and you see this eine Bärenmutter,
the mother of a bear, it's the entry of the village.
Hineingeht in das Häuptlingshaus, in den geheimen Teil des Hauses. Haben Sie in der Ausstellung?
Yeah, and concerning your notion of or your account of this idea of a second prehistory linked to the atomic bomb, well, then of course Wolfgang Palen is also a crucial figure. And indeed, there's a really nice Palen vitrine in the exhibition. There's so much good stuff in this exhibition.
Oh, yes.
Spend lots of time in it.
Yes, but you have to open the books.
Yeah. Okay, so Anselm, you're going to take off the glass plates, right, and then we can all.
We have really to make the books fun.
Thank you very much. And when do we reconvene? At 7, I guess? Okay, at 6:30.